2001 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium, Session 175, Are We Growing Up Yet? Relating Across Gender Barriers. Participants Paul Swenson, Leanna Ray Scott, Nancy Saxton, Jan Bartlett, and Glenn Lambert.
I might turn out to be immoderate in that I will have opinions, and the panel originated sort of in my head. And it started with a poem, and I would like to read that poem to you now. And hopefully that will give you a hint of where I came from and how this panel started to develop. And actually, before I do that, I want to introduce the panel. On my right is Leanna Ray Scott. And by the way, we wrote our own bios, and then they were somewhat truncated and edited in the Sunstone process. So they were witty at one time.
Read my own first.
Paul Swenson, journalist, poet, film critic, feminist. He has a new life, a new marriage, a new family. I think it then said a new puppy and a bumper sticker that reads, Shift Happens. Which is true. I've been through a lot of shift in the last couple of years. So then, why don't you read yours?
They just brought it. Thanks, Eric. we just got some. Thanks.
Leanna Ray Scott, writer, feminist, film buff, mother of 13, grandmother of 25, with a new country, new career. Something else was new, but I can't remember what it was. And a passport ready to fly.
My name is Glenn Lambert. Let's see. I'm the executive director of Odyssey House. I'm assistant clinical professor at the University of Utah. I also have a private practice in psychotherapy.
And contrary to what it says on here, I have to read mine because the one I had didn't even have it in here. And I'm not a former city council person. I'm presently a city council person, unless something's changed and I didn't know. So community activist, former, but scratch that, Salt Lake City councilwoman, married to her best friend.
And I'm Jan Bartlett, her husband, so I guess if that makes her a city council person, am I a first man? I don't know what that makes me. I'm a Presbyterian minister, a tree surgeon, and co-owner of Salt Air Bed and Breakfast.
Here is the poem to kick us off. And by the way, after we each take a short turn, or short or longer, as the case may be, we'll then come back to some general discussion and open it to you. And we'd very much like you to participate. This is a poem called Woman. Lady is a word so laden with euphemistic kitsch that it obscures the laughter and the heat and inflicts deletions in the psyche. Females in their 20s, in offices and kitchens, in Phoenix and Wichita, transist from girls to ladies without a fair audition for the leading role of woman. The word may once have had some elegance and grace, but now tastes bogus in the mouths of boys who use it to save face because they can't engage their glacial fear of women. If you're male, please don't introduce me to the little lady until you're eager to be known as little gentleman. I want the passion, intellect, and taste of woman. You may have noticed that in casual conversation, many people, and sometimes we ourselves, use the words girl, lady, or woman as interchangeable. Women in their 40s or more or less may say, my girlfriend, or speak of themselves as girls, girls' night out. And men may speak of having some association with male friends as boys' night out. I don't know what it is if we want to make ourselves feel younger, identify with a time when we didn't have adult responsibility, or if, you know, the words boys and girls apply to ourselves, if we don't want to confront the fact that the terms men and women imply some things, imply some sexual heat, imply some adult conversation and responsibility. Maybe we all yearn for a time when we were boys and girls. Ladies is a problematical term. What does lady mean? Well, at one time maybe it did mean, as I tried to say in the poem, maybe it had some specificity. Often now I hear it used in a way that sort of makes me cringe. Makes me feel as if when we call a woman a lady, we elevate that person to a pedestal that takes her out of human interaction. Something untouchable, something unreachable, something that is hard to define. Well, I want to, with that short introduction, I want to turn this question over to the panel, and then I want to ask also about the terms brother and sister, which are terms we use in the LDS Church from time to time. Although I must say, when somebody comes up to me in the foyer of the chapel and says, brother so-and-so, it makes me feel older for some reason. And it makes me feel less personal about who I am and who they are. Shouldn't be that way, maybe. I think that the idea of thinking of ourselves and each other as brothers and sisters is an important idea. But if you're in a ward for a certain length of time and you don't know the first name of a person who addresses you as sister so-and-so or brother so-and-so, it erects a sort of subtle barrier to communication, it seems to me. I don't know how to take care of that or address that, but that's what this panel is about, and that's what this question is about for us and for all of you. So thank you for coming, and I hope you will participate.
Throughout my adult years, I've increasingly become aware of gender inequality in our society, which inequality harms both men and women, I feel. But as much as I was aware of some of the things women suffered as a result of this gender inequality, I didn't become aware of how much everyday language plays a part in this until I took an introductory feminist course about 11 years ago. I hadn't noticed how even my own language was involved in the process. As far as the boys-girls thing, referring to men and women, I think in our society, much more often, women are referred to as girls than men referred to as boys. And, of course, you know, this plays a part in how women aren't treated equally because we're treated as children. The ladies, gentlemen thing, that's been a real bugbear for me for a number of years now, because women are much more often referred to as ladies than men are referred to as gentlemen. If you don't believe that, I believe we're probably all members of the choir here, but just in case, if you don't believe that, just check out the restroom signs and see how often they're they're not equivalent. Many people, even women themselves, habitually refer to women as ladies. In my written work, I don't do that anymore because I edit that out. If I start to write ladies, I change it. But in my verbal interactions, I still sometimes refer to women as ladies. It's such a habit. For example, a week or so ago at the airport, I needed to get the attention of a group of women. And I just couldn't bring myself to say, "Women!" because I thought they would, you know, look at me with blank stares or something. And so I called out ladies. Many people today even still defend their use of the term lady, saying that it's a way of showing respect for women. Sometimes when I challenge people, and I don't do it all the time, but sometimes I do in a friendly, non-confrontational way, but I still will explain my perception about that term. And they think they're appalled that it's offensive to people, female people. I can understand that they think they're being respectful with this term, but I also see the huge downside for women in it. The overall effect of calling women ladies is that women's behavior is controlled. Let me give you an example. Dad walks through his own unoccupied kitchen, and his children in the next room hear him loudly pass gas. His children say, "Good one, Dad." Mom does the same thing, and the kids say, "Mom!" This is one of the types of things that happen from putting women in this category. Ladies shouldn't fart or belch or anything like it, even in the privacy and comfort of their own homes. Ladies shouldn't ever swear or express anger in any way, or even feel angry. Ladies shouldn't choose masculine professions, or maybe even any profession. Ladies shouldn't be successfully independent, or autonomous, or assertive. Ladies should be compliant. Ladies should be who they are expected to be, and do the things they are expected to do, such as set and maintain the emotional tone in the home. Calling women ladies may seem a fairly innocuous thing, but I believe this verbal control mechanism is just as effective in controlling women as has been any physical control mechanism, such as the binding of women's feet or the removal of her clitoris. Another use of language that serves to control women is that of referring to women in sexual terms. The English language has thousands more sexual references for women than it does for men. I can't quote you the reference for this because I temporarily, I hope, lost my textbook that I was referring to. Many equivalent terms have a sexual connotation for women, but not for men. For example, sir and madam. There are many, many that have that in the English language. Of course, we're all aware that many sexual references to women are very derogatory. Bitch, whore, slut, cunt, to name a few. The word bitch is particularly offensive because it is not only used against women using the sexual connotation, but it also is used in reference to crankiness or nastiness. But in those cases, it never quite drops the sexual connotation either. It's also used against women who are just plain assertive or intolerant of abuse. This practice of referring to women in sexual terms serves to keep women in a subservient role in our society. Our language serves as an agent of social control. And in reference to the brother-sister terminology that we use in the church, as a convert of about 25 years now, I have to say I've never enjoyed being called sister, whatever my name was at the time. It's changed a few times. It feels to me that it goes along with the depersonalization thing that women have in society. We're nameless. It feels to me. I don't know what the the solution is to it either, but I have to say that I don't particularly like it being called sister. I like the concept, but I don't like being called Sister Scott, although I do use it myself when I don't know people's first names. So I don't know what the solution is on that one.
Just as an aside, my kids, when I fart, just say, "Dad, did you fart?" So, my experience. And also, can you hear me okay? Okay. I'd also like to acknowledge my wife here and how I got on this panel. They were asking me to respond to a number of papers, and I said, well, actually, I'm really interested in Paul Swenson's topic, and then I got a phone call, so... And totally off, I just heard this, is that in marriage we are to become one. Then the fight begins about which one we become. My presentation's a little more formal in a Sunstone format. I agree with the assumption that feminist Gloria Steinem once said, men like women live in cages. Their cages may be gilded, they live in cages nevertheless. Indeed, many people, cultures, and institutions do live in cages, often at cost to themselves and others. Men and women are summations of many things, including their biology, as well as the roles, language, and concepts they were taught about themselves. Language can free us and allow us to grow. It can also constrain us, hurt us, confuse us, deny us, and not make us whole. While some have rightfully grown in their awareness, inserted their right to leave restrictive gender roles that do not work, many have lagged far behind because multiple forces still exert their pressure on what it means to be a woman or a man. The terms we use to describe roles and the meaning we assign to those terms can work in complicated but powerful and sometimes unintended ways. This lack of awareness, about this can be illustrated by two instances that I experienced as a therapist. In the first, a depressed woman cried and agonized and asked me what was wrong with her. She said that she had everything a good Mormon woman would want. Her husband was a bishop. He was successful and earned good money. He was dedicated. Indeed, he was so dedicated, he was rarely, if ever, home. In the meantime, she was a full-time homemaker and mother of five children, seven and under. She wondered what was wrong. Was she bad? How could she have all of this and not be happy? The second experience was in couple counseling. The wife was berating her husband about not fulfilling his patriarchal husband role enough by scheduling more prayers, spiritual events, and by being more serious. He responded by saying he wanted to have more fun with the family. I asked her where she got her model from about what a patriarch was. She responded by saying that it was from her father. Interestingly, two sessions later, she stated that as a child, she had learned to really resent her father because of his control, rigidity, and lack of closeness. She then surprised herself by saying she actually enjoyed the family's fun, but she was still worried that her family may not make it to heaven. Other issues aside, these two cases illustrated the complex ways in which the concepts of what maleness and females are supposed to be about are passed on and held on to despite evidence that they do not work. In the first, the woman denied her own feelings and burdens because of a personal and cultural sense of what a good Mormon wife should feel. She blamed herself. That same prescription may have also denied the husband of more quality time with his wife and children and a greater sense of sharing. In the second event, the generational role modeling and terminology was getting in the way of dealing in the present and recognizing a new paradigm of how to live family life. Awareness can be a key and can open up wonderful avenues of relating, communicating, and growth. And hopefully this panel is about awareness. We often hide behind terminology as we set a lifetime setting our sails by the role definitions we think we have been taught. What makes the future seems fearful to some in that our current world and culture often reaffirms the terminology and self-definitions of femaleness and maleness. I sense, however, that as long as we only play our roles instead of taking our collective and personal journeys, we never fully know ourselves, feel loved for ourselves, truly connect with others, and know the freedom and growth that comes from exploring our possibilities. I'd now like to turn to four conclusions about this topic. First, labels and words and the meanings we ascribe to them matter. They can have positive and negative consequences. What one sees as positive can hurt another. Definitions can be used to push agendas and control patterns. Let me give a brief aside. I remember in a priesthood meeting about a lesson about how I was supposed to be a husband and the patriarch and how the woman was supposed to be the obedient, whatever, I can't go there, vessel. I had kept my silence in agitation until one husband responded by saying, "It's like this. God calls the prophet, and the prophet calls the Jordan River Temple president. And no matter how good a guy that temple president is, if he doesn't do what the prophet says, the prophet needs to get rid of him, and that's the way a marriage should be." That ended my silence as I asked, what does that mean? If your wife disagrees with you, are you supposed to divorce her? He got very angry, and I should say he's divorced today. Let me throw out some terms to you that come to mind that are often used in regards to gender. Notice what images and feelings they evoke in you and what behavioral prescriptions they can demand. Your projections may vary from the person sitting next to you, but all these words evoke strong conceptions and imagery. In the societal context, there's a woman, man, lady, gentleman, boy, girl, miss, Ms., and Mrs. In other words, there's only one responsible way to be a woman, and Mr. Wife, an old maid or homemaker, and bachelor or menace to society. Mother, father, princess, prince. These terms carry a lot of punch and rules. As an illustration, my son was taking a sociology class this last year, and he copied these words as given by the class describing men and women. For women, sensitive, modest, feminine, passive, indecisive, demanding, quiet, dainty, maternal, dependent, caring. Men, strong, powerful, competitive, unemotional, rowdy, wild, tough, smart, masculine. Of course, these carry a lot of rules. For women, be feminine, be giving, depend on others, be a mother. For men, no sissy or feminine stuff, be a big wheel, be strong as a sturdy oak, give them hell, and be a provider. All these roles and stereotypes have enormous connotations and pave the way for results that robs both women and men of their full potentiality. Let me move to some other words. In sexuality, the words are extraordinarily telling about our differing attitudes. For women, for example, seductress, whore, slut. I couldn't find any equivalent for men other than stud, or boys will be boys. Religion presents another huge has it. Sister, brother. Sister, or maybe Relief Society president, and brother, deacon, teacher, priest, elder, high priest, bishop, patriarch, high councilman, state president, 70, apostle, prophet, and even God. There is handmaiden with no male equivalency. These terms can be used and twisted to justify even the most extreme behavior. For example, the language in criminal behavior and domestic violence is even more rigid and sexist. In Scully's and Morella's studies entitled Convictus Rapist's Vocabulary of Motive, they found that the justification of rapists were socially reinforced often, such as women are seductresses, nice girls don't get raped, and women will relax and enjoy it. In both family physical and sexual abuse, the language and roles are often very rigid and very patriarchal. Secondly, religion can really up the ante. All cultures have rules about genders. But religion adds power to these because it often ascribes them to God, and therefore they are right, true, non-debatable, and often eternal. Where concepts are deified, they often become entrenched. Nowhere is this more powerfully illustrated than in Afghanistan, where women are denied leaving their houses, working, education, and even health care. Muhammad, in his way, liberated women of his times in many ways and gave them property and inheritance rights, elevated them above property status, and gave them permission to leave violence. However, it would seem the fundamentalist interpretations of this have remained stuck in that time, at least in Afghanistan. And how about Mormon culture? In the article, Four C's of Mormon Family, Chastity, Conjugality, Children, and Chauvinism, Tim Heaton of BYU cites research indicating that Mormons have often rigid conceptions of marital sex roles and parenting styles. For example, Mormons are about twice as likely to have to take a traditional position, with the mother being the homemaker and the father the breadwinner, than the rest of the national sample. Moreover, in comparing role definitions and role enactments, Mormons have different patterns than other religious groups and are less egalitarian in concepts of who should take and perform the role of provider, housekeeper, the care of children, socializing children, and home repair. Indeed, when issues of chauvinism is stated strictly in terms of who has the power to make final decisions on these roles, Mormon women have less power than in any other religious or non-religious groups, except with being comparable to some fundamentalist Christians. Information about the younger Mormons suggests these trends may continue, since Mormon college students score higher on macho scales than any other religious or non-religious group, except being comparable to strict fundamental Christians. These divisions of the sexes are reinforced by separate youth programs for adolescents, for males and females, and by Relief Society and priesthood meetings for adults. 3. The turns and concepts cut both ways. Bishops, I just had to tell a little story that we recently got called in our bishop about a year and a half ago, and he welcomed the little women and said, but I don't know who was more offended, because he said, oh, we're so happy to have the little women here. I would just be helpless without mine, and we would all be helpless without our little women. And I don't know who was more offended, my wife for being called a little woman, or for me, because I didn't want to be seen as so helpless. Concepts that we use to define the other gender also deny and restrict in other ways, or who we are in that gender. This can be illustrated by the often tragic lack of quality fathering. The very definitions that push women to be the primary parent and the warm parenting figure often is the same definition that provide the lack of reinforcement, encouragement, permission, and responsibility for fathers to be more fully involved in their children's lives. The results can be tragic to men, women, and children. And fourth, the times they are changing. And reality is often different than the conceptions we verbally profess. I find that in the real world where people live, the gender roles are often worked out in very different creative and practical ways. Even with our own culture, where we teach that gender roles are different and God-given, roles amongst the men and women have changed dramatically over the last 100 years, and particularly in the last 30 years. After all I have said, I am encouraged by a more open consideration of these matters and the movement and growth by both women and men. We may have lengths to go, but we have also come a ways. A male patient of mine was once going on about his pain and self-loathing he felt in perceived inability to live up to the American male Mormon role expectations and what qualities he was deficient in. I asked him instead to describe his humanness and what qualities that entailed. His demeanor changed to one of peace and acceptance as he described his own humanity, which he treasured. The thought struck me about how many people perceive their humanness so positively and how it is freeing and caring, but that when they get into their own sex roles, they often feel much disappointment, anger, conflict, and confinement. Humanness, it would seem, doesn't carry the same baggage. Maybe we should expend more energy in discovering and developing our humanity other than fighting to reach our flawed conceptions of maleness and femaleness. In the beautiful children's book, Sam Johnson and the Blue Ribbon Quilt, a man discovers a quilt why he's building, a quilt design why when building. He then asks some women if he can join the quilting group to develop his newfound interest. They turn him down because men aren't supposed to quilt. Hurt, he goes to the men and appeals to their competitiveness, and they form their own group to compete with the women at the fair. Both groups work secretly and exclusively. As fables would have it, the two groups run into each other in a mad rush to the fair, and both quilts blow into the mud and become soiled. After protestation, they work together, taking parts of both quilts and combining them. They then win the blue ribbon because the shared and combined quilt was the most beautiful. Maybe in real life we can pool our efforts, allow new possibilities, see beyond our constrictions and limitation, and accept potentiality. Maybe we should speak to each other and see each other without the labels, and just maybe our individual and collective life quilts can become more beautiful. Oh, yeah. Forgot it was.
Yeah. We really like each other, so you know, it's okay for me to ask that question. So. You know, it's so interesting to hear people talk about the gender, and I know when I was asked to serve on the panel, I thought, gee, I don't know that I'm really the right person for this. I was raised in a very small town in Northern California, and I had a brother that was 6 years older than I. But what was most important is that really the running around town I could do kind of equally equal to my brother, so there weren't a lot of restrictions on me on where I could go and who I could go with, but it was a small town, and so I think that was part of it, that it wasn't safe for girls to be out, and so it's okay for the boys. So that's kind of where it started. But as I think as many things are for us in our life, so much is given to us from our dear parents, whether it's for good or for ill. In my family, my father was a very hardworking man, but there was no doubt about it. He was a manly man. But he spent a lot of time away from the family, out of the country, actually, in Canada. I as American, probably know more about Canada than most Americans do, just because my father had a business there. But it was a laboring kind of business. And so because of that, my mother, who I really term as a super mom, in that not only did she bake, she cooked extremely well, made a cooked breakfast every day of my life, made all of my clothes, she built furniture, she was a great homemaker, she was a woman in the city that participated and volunteered, she worked outside of the home, and she was really one of my best friends as I was growing up, and she was a great mom. And so because of that, she was the perfect wife. When my father would walk in the door, she suddenly became very subservient. It was amazing transformation that would happen like that. And this was a woman who was extremely capable and very bright. And, you know, and as a child, you see that, and at some point it registers to you, but, you know, it just becomes part of your life, and so you don't really think, you think everybody looks that way, and it's no different. But what I soon realized is that was a role, and the way that my mother performed that role was something that she was very comfortable with. She is still, the church is just the rod in her life. And she's very happy being in that role, but she's also very comfortable playing baseball or doing any other sport that maybe the boys would generally do, and she would do it quite well. You know, so as I was growing up, I felt very comfortable in dresses. I was very comfortable out getting dirty and playing with the boys, and, you know, and I could give them a real run for their money, whether it was basketball or football or anything else. But I didn't feel uncomfortable in my role as the daughter or as the sister or as the girl. But I didn't really see myself that way. I was who I was, and I had that example from my mother. As I grew up, in the church and eventually went on a mission, I realized that those same examples to me permeated my life in the mission field. You know, I knew, and I would tell people the reason I was there as really it was a helpmate, really, to the elders. But I was also very quick to remind people that the sisters are only out for a year and a half, and the elders are out for 2 years because it only takes us a year and a half to do 2 years' worth of work. And I really, I mean, there's a part of me that believes that. In the mission field, I had a wonderful mission president who had some misgivings about sister missionaries, but he was very glad to see me come out because I was kind of, you know, the bull in the china cabinet kind of a thing. And my companion and I, almost throughout my mission, we out-taught and out-baptized any of the elders throughout the whole mission. Of course, I never got into the water, and the elders always reminded me of that, but, you know, it didn't really make any difference to me. What I was doing, I felt passionate about, and I think I had my own way of doing things. So, again, it wasn't so important to me that I was a sister or I was a girl. I just did what I did. I want to tell you that in response to a couple of things that the others have mentioned, one, I believe strongly in evolution. And I think the fact that we're even here at Sunstone, that we're here talking about the terms of female versus male or gender kinds of barriers, is because we as humans have that ability to evolve. That in the days where it used to be gentlemen and ladies or whatever it might be, that definitely was a social kind of position, and you nary would step outside of that. Today, it doesn't really matter. We were talking at the breakfast table this morning about, you know, to wear black to a wedding would be just a terrible thing. It's a sign of not being in favor of the wedding that's taking place. Well, now it's quite vogue on the East Coast for the maids of honor or to wear black. They wear black dresses, and the bride still wears white or whatever. And so that's really changed. So who is it that wrote the etiquette book?
Emily
Post. Thank you very much. Emily Post is probably, you know, not so important. I couldn't even remember her name, and I don't even know if anybody's ever read it. But some people do remind me that I need to maybe keep up with that a bit more. When we talk about brothers and sisters, as I was growing up, that was just kind of part of my life, to call each other brothers and sisters. But for me, it was out of respect. And I know historically that we call each other brothers and sisters because in the old days it was to remind each other that we are all very equal, that it didn't matter if someone was a doctor or someone had a lot of money, that we were all equal in the eyes of God. And I thought that was quite endearing, but I remember as I became 18 or 20, even in my home ward, that the stake president's wife, the bishop's wife, even members of the ward would say, you know, call me Janet. And they would initiate that, giving me permission that I was now their equal and that we were on a much more personal kind of relationship, which I remember I was a bit taken aback by that because of my religious upbringing, that was not necessarily a negative thing to call each other brother and sister, but it was kind of the great equalizer, kind of like the internet. But that they reminded me, being actually an older generation, that now we really were equals and that I could call them by their first name. My mission president did the same thing when I met with him after my mission. He initiated calling me Nancy right away and asked me to call him by his first name, which was George, and also asked me to play golf with him. The other term, when I talked about evolution, that I think is really important, the other one is that Glenn couldn't think of another word for a man other than stud. I have one, and no one's mentioned it. It's called drone. Jan and I, we did not, I was 33 years old before I married. And Jan was 38. And I can tell you that I raised a lot of eyebrows in my home ward, and then when I moved out to Utah, I mean, people really thought there was something really drastically wrong with me. You know, I'd been active in the church, I'd served a mission, I'd really been a good girl, hadn't been promiscuous, I really had a good job, and seemed to kind of be able to put one foot in front of the other, and so nobody could really quite figure out why I wasn't married. Well, I can tell you, you know, I don't know why I wasn't married, but I can tell you that I never really fit the mold of the typical Mormon woman or Mormon girl. One, I didn't like to cook, and I never cooked for any of my dates. I told them, I'm not going to cook for you because I don't plan on doing it if and when we ever get married, so I'm not going to do it now. And so it just never really fit. I was always very outspoken, always very opinionated, thus the politics, I guess. And always felt like I had lots of abilities, and my parents always told me that I could do anything I wanted. They never told me what I had to do. They just said, go to college, you can do anything you want. There was never a list of kind of the best job and job description for me. I don't know where this comes from. It doesn't matter to me if somebody calls me Ms. It doesn't matter to me if they call me Sister. It doesn't even matter to me if they call me Mister. When I was elected to the city council, I am the only woman of seven that are on the council. So my male counterparts, when they were trying to be very respectful and asked me how I wanted to be addressed, it didn't even enter my mind that most of the time they're called councilmen. And so they said, do you want to be called councilwoman, councilperson? I said, you know, it doesn't matter to me. I'll answer to anything. And I don't know, again, where that comes from. I'm not insulted. I'm not put off if people call me by a female kind of term. But I can tell you, by looking at me, no one has ever called me the little woman. It's never been part of my life that I've had to overcome for some strange reason. Um, So for me, again, I guess I feel myself as a woman. There are instincts that that I know that I have that is unique for women. I value those. I cherish those. But I also know that there are some aspects like vacuuming that is a weakness. If you ever see a man vacuum, they're going to go all the way up to that wall and come all the way back. And they're going to do the whole wall that way, the whole room that way. But for a woman, the way we vacuum, we go all the way around and we move on to the next place. Now that's much more efficient to go up and back and up. It's much more mundane. But everybody has kind of their own uniqueness, I think, as far as the different aspects of our gender. And I think they're to be valued, reveled in, and enjoyed. Let's see.
In regards to what you just said, Nancy.
Yeah.
Jan, I think, mentioned to me a story about what you were called by someone in the city council, or a reference was made to you that was both enlightening and
shocking. Oh. Oh, yeah. Because I'm the only woman, I have a young man, a man who serves on a committee with me. And he came up to me and he said, Councilwoman Saxton, and addressed me, shook my hand and kind of bowed to me. And he said, oh, are these your boys? Meaning the other men on the council. And the other council members got a big kick out of that. And I said, well, no, they're actually council members as well. And they continue to call themselves Nancy or Councilwoman Saxton and the boys. So that's gotten to be kind of a joke with us.
Why do you think they get a kick out of that?
You know, I think because they've become very comfortable with me. Initially, they were very... I think it was a bit tense when I first came on. I think women, as women, because... It is a man's world. I mean, I can look out there to the women in the audience that work out in the world, and it is a man's world. And there are times when women, as we break into it, whether it's at work or politics or leadership, whatever it might be, that just like my mother could put on her apron as soon as my dad walked into the house, you know, and be the homemaker. And when he was gone, you know, she was out doing what she liked to do, and that was, you know, playing baseball or building furniture, whatever it might have been, or cooking for us.
Did she ever play baseball with
your dad? Oh, she did. No, and she did. But what I mean is that she had that ability to kind of disconnect or move into another modality. I think for women, oftentimes that we tend to kind of stiffen up a bit when we have to go out and be in the world. That's my experience, because I think that sometimes we sense that that's what the world expects of us when we're in a leadership role or when we're in a high profile position. And because of that, I think sometimes we, as I often do, I speak louder than I need to, and I am a bit more overbearing than what I need to be. And that was kind of the experience, I think, from some of the council members, that that's what they had anticipated. But when that didn't happen, I think there was a much more accepting kind of feeling from my counterparts, and that has continued. I just want to close with a couple things. When we talk about knitting and, you know, and the warm fuzzy things that women do, a lot of it, I think, is cultural. We had a guest that was staying with us that was from England. And he reminded us that in England, it is a standard practice and standard procedure that the men take a homemaking class, and they cook, they sew, they do needlepoint, they knit, they do all of those things that, to tell you the truth, I never even took those classes to do, but that generally we would take in home ec as women. And what would the men take?
Auto-mechanics.
Well, I didn't even think of auto mechanics, but yes, shop or auto mechanics. And in my day, men never, never went to home ec class. I mean, it just did not happen. We did it, I think, my senior year, just to rotate them through. We have a man that's in touch with his feminine side back there. Good for you. And with that, I had an opportunity recently in flying back to California, and this gentleman I was sitting next to, he was looking out the window and everything. He was definitely a granola guy. Everybody knows, kind of, you know, he had his sandals on and everything, with the little dirt still under his fingernails and all that kind of stuff. And pretty soon he whips out the satchel and whips out his knitting. Boy, did we start up a conversation. I was amazed. He pulls out his knitting and he starts just knit. I mean, this guy, I mean, you could tell he was into it. He knew exactly where he was going with these needles. And he said he started knitting about 15 years ago because he was doing, when he was doing some ski guiding, and he'd be in these, the kind of the shacks, you know, out and away. He said, I got tired of reading, so I decided to do something constructive. So he started, taught himself to knit. And he still knits, and he knits socks and all kinds of things and gives them away as gifts. And I relayed to him what they do in England compared to the United States. My husband and I, when I was on my mission, we didn't call each other like who was in charge for that particular week when you would be make the decisions for the twosome. We called each other bishop because we saw ourselves really in a leadership role. I had elders that called me elder. I was Elder Saxton. So I think part of it is who we are and how we carry ourselves is what we elicit to the people around us. If we feel that we're an equal, we're always going to be kind of kicked in the shins once in a while. But I think generally if we see ourselves as an equal, we'll be taken as an equal. And I think, I don't know how that starts, but I think it starts very early. And that's why as parents, it's essential for us to see our children as equals, equal with each other, the boys and the girls. Thank you. Oh, you want this now? Okay.
My name is Jan. And I'm probably the only person here that's ever been thought of as a woman. When I go to preach on Sunday morning, I go to places where people don't know me. And my guess is that they sit there thinking, oh, to hear a woman preach. And I don't know how that affects their response to what I do say, since they find out I'm a man. Anyway, I think they think that initially. You knew who you were then. Girls were girls and men were men. May not recognize the song, but that was from, you know what?
That was a song?
Yeah, Archie Bunker. Girls were girls and men were men. I don't know why that thing keeps flipping through my head every so often. It just comes to me. I remember in college, when I was in college, my professors were Dr. So-and-so and Dr. So-and-so. Until one of my friends, Yank Albers, started calling them Bill and John. I thought the ceiling was going to fall in. I couldn't believe that somebody my age could call these men and women by their first name. Nothing happened. And it was wonderful because none of them said, call me Dr. So-and-so. None of them. And by the time we graduated from college, everyone was on a first name basis. There was a lot that happened in my college in those 4 years that I was there. At our bed and breakfast, which is called Salter Bed and Breakfast, is a little ad. We may take reservations. One of the things that we've noticed is that everyone gives their first name and their last name. And usually whoever is their significant other that's traveling with them. Except one category of people. And it's not the whole category, but it's only some of them. Medical doctors. Even their wives refer to them, I am Mrs. Doctor so-and-so. It is amazing to us that in all the changes that have taken place, that is the one category that has not changed at all.
They aren't even real doctors.
That's right. I'm one of these men who is, I'm becoming more and more aware, driven. I don't even know where it comes from. I don't even know how to stop it. I am driven daily to write lists of tasks to do. And I will race as fast as I can get through them, hoping to get to the end. That would be my life story, I think, if I wasn't married to Nancy. Fortunately, she will call me away and say, you know, we really need to go and eat. This would be nice to go, and you can take me out to a movie.
She doesn't cook.
You're making some good connections here.
It's not that I can't cook. I just don't.
I'm just so struck at times how connected I am as a man. And again, I don't know about the other men here, but I'm not one of these guys that talks to other men often or easily. And I don't know how many of you are so closely identified with what you do that you almost lose your sense of your person, but I do. I watch myself build things, and I love how they turn out. I am really good at all kinds of things, and I take a great deal of pride when I'm done. But as I get older, I look back at those tasks that really look, things that I built that really look good when I built them. And now 5 and 10 years later, they don't look so good anymore. They need to be redone. And all of a sudden, as I'm getting older and my tasks are getting older too and they look worn, I start to wonder about who am I, because I identify so closely with what I do. It is very frightening, I think, at times, and even a hazard to be a man. I think many of us have no idea at times what we feel, why we're being driven to do what we do, or how to stop once we become aware of it. So if there's a problem being a woman, I got news for you. There's a big problem being a man. Sometimes I am envious. Envious and jealous of women. You all seem to have the flexibility to change and to move, to sit down and talk with each other in ways that even when I attempt to with guys, we never quite get there. And I find myself missing that. Someone wrote, unlike the problems of women, the problems of men are not readily changed through legislation. I made a list of things, such as the right to vote, your place when you get divorced, child support, employment and in hiring practices, maternity leave. So many of the things that women have said are problems in their lives are fixed or are moved along, at least, by legislation. I'm scratching my head trying to think of what it is for we men, what legislation would have to take place to move us along. Sometimes I don't even think we're aware enough of our pains and our hurts and where we're not healthy to devise some piece of legislation. I think unfortunately a lot of us men will not move or change in a constructive way because the motivation for us seems to come out of shame, guilt, fear, and self-hatred. And I don't know about you, I'm not motivated by those anymore. So there's got to be something else for a man. Actually, the shame, guilt, and all is really the old-time religion way. It is no wonder to me in the Presbyterian Church that our numbers are falling off. When was the last time you heard, you've come a long way, buddy? No, I think a lot of us men are really, at times, very selfish, horny, and unhappy.
What a monster.
A few times I've been approached by a young Mormon who will say to me, don't you want to be with her forever? I've never thought to say, oh, I get a choice? Or, oh, so your members have that choice? Or once you become a member of your church, you don't have a choice. You're lost. You are fixed. I don't know how that works. There's a rock and roll song that has the line, money ain't nothing if the chicks are free. Money ain't for nothing if the chicks are free. I think there really is an envy and a yearning in men for many of the qualities they see in the women. They don't know how to incorporate them into themselves. They recognize, sometimes to our dismay, that we need the women, but that's not part of the role of being a man, is to be needy. It creates tremendous conflict. I think it's an interesting question just to ask, as long as we're going to use term of men and women. At what age do you think you become, or anyone, becomes an adult? I asked a gal who works for us, who's 20 years old. She's recently discovered that she's pregnant. And I said to her, you consider yourself, you think of yourself as an adult. You think of yourself as a woman. She said, no. I said, when do you think you might consider yourself that way? She thought for a minute. She said, I think after I have the baby, that after I have more responsibilities, then I will be an adult. I really like that Paul invited me onto this panel, because the first day he explained to me what he wanted us to think about. This idea of calling females women, and not other things like girls, gals, chicks, on and on. And not that I think that I did, but I must have. Because I find at times it's an effort to think and to only refer to females, usually over 20, as women. And I find that it has an effect on me. That I do see you women as more equal when I say that word, rather than gals. It's amazing. I'm affected by that awareness. I didn't have it before. So I'm really glad that this is taking place for me. And I've wondered about this in terms of being analogous to what's happened in the black community. Those human beings, for the longest time, were never called men or women. Just that term alone, I think, could have made all the difference. But they were called other names. So I think what we call each other really is important and worth thinking about. My comments?
Passing the ritual, passing in the mind.
Are you waiting?
Well, I'm embarrassed that the program refers to Nancy as former councilwoman. How the heck that happened, I have no idea. She's not a former anything. She's all there all the time at the minute you're talking to her. All right. I wasn't going to suggest that. But I do want to say that Nancy is going to a council meeting, is that true? And has to leave at 6. So I think before she leaves, we ought to open it up to the audience. And if your first questions, if you have questions of Nancy, ask them now. And would you be willing to come up and use this tiny little inconvenient microphone to speak into? Because there is a tape being made, and you hate to hear someone from the back of the room mumbling something that you can't quite hear. So
we could,
but I... whichever my foot. I want people to come up here and speak into the microphone. Because it just makes it easier and simpler and more direct. So if you've been thinking about what you think about this stuff we've been discussing and you have some opinions of your own or some questions of your own, could we have the first brave person who will ask or say something? Don't all rush up here at once. No, take it easy. Can you?
I didn't include this, and I was thinking about it, but I've also been thinking about terms we use for single males and females and the different connotations that take. But I discovered a twist recently because we had a neighbor whose parents' lifetime ambition was to go on a mission together. And they were from Rexburg, the parents, and so he retired. And he and his wife went into the mission home and were very excited. She was having headaches, and they told her to go to the doctor. Bye, Nancy. It's great to see you. And so this is more of an illustration of what our culture does and really interesting ways, I think, about gender. And she went to the doctor and found out she had cancer, and she was dead within 3 weeks. He grieved... But he still wanted to do this lifetime ambition. So in about 2 months, he went back, because he had never been released, and said, I'm ready now to serve, even though my wife is gone. And I had never known this, but they told him that he was not eligible to go on a mission because he was single. If he were a female, he could go on a mission. But as an older male... he could not go on a mission, that he needed to find a wife in order to go on a mission. And, of course, that's what he did. And I also, you know, talking about the single thing, we're in an older ward, and so there's a singles group, and most of them are over 45. Most of them are widows. You know, they've had profession, they're competent, they're bright. But yet they have to have a married couple, usually 23, to run their group because they are not allowed as single people to do that. And as you look through the different kinds of rules in very subtle sorts of ways, I mean, I doubt there's ever been a male primary president, for example. And we certainly have never had a female bishop. But there's all these kind of really interesting rules when you get into the culture that tell us the kind of projections we have. Like, I'm not sure what... I guess he's a dirty old man, so he can't go. I don't know.
She has a question.
Could you come up, please?
I just said I was a Christian.
Could you come up, please?
No, that's just a joke.
It's not a joke. It's for the tape.
That's okay. Do what you want.
All right. I'm sorry. Say it once more loudly.
There may never have been a male primary president, but I was once the priesthood ordinance.
Really?
I love it.
I'm quite disappointed because nothing was done before it happened.
I've been waiting to get insight on all the secrets in the priesthood.
There aren't any.
Any questions or comments?
Well, it's more of a comment, and then maybe folks on the panel can jump in and respond to it. I actually been thinking about this quite a bit myself lately and came to the conclusion a few months back that we ought to have some kind of a moratorium in the church on using the reference brother and sister when we talk to each other. I was kind of at a miss, though, as to, you know, what we would come up with an alternative.
mine didn't have so much to do with it, kind of all the cultural baggage was associated with it, but rather an awareness after spending some time working through all sorts of gender issues in the New Testament, in terms of things Jesus did and taught, as well as Paul. It's kind of interesting that Paul originally, although there's some disagreement, I think he was clearly one of the original people who started this model of using the appellation brother and sister to refer to each other as members within the church. And it's a very strident, if you look at the context of the time and what he was doing with that, it was a very, very strident exercise in anti-language. Because at the time, the closest and most intimate bonds and relationships between people in his society was between siblings. It was not between spouses. And the worst act of betrayal would be a brother betraying a brother or a sister betraying a sister. It was not a husband or a wife betraying each other like we think of today. And so when Jesus would say things, you know, like, in the final days, even brother would turn against brother, you know, you're supposed to go, oh my gosh, you know, the world can't get any worse than that. And so when Paul was using that title, you know, calling each other brother and sister, and then trying to get the members of the church to use it with each other, it was a very difficult labor on his part to get them to really understand that they were no longer competing amongst each other as males and females like they would in the larger society, but that they really had to, you know, embrace an entire new mental model about how they should view these relationships with each other. Today in the church, I mean, brother and sister is more of a formal title that when I use it, you know, it's more of a separation of distance rather than an act of anti-language to bring me closer to each other. But, I mean, you know, the use of language is very powerful in terms of the underlying mental models that it communicates and the assumptions that we make about our relationships with each other. But there's kind of a circular effect. You know, we use the language to communicate mental models, and then the mental models can spring from that language and reinforce things in kind of a circular fashion. But anyway, it's more of an observation than really a question, but if you have any reactions, I'd love to hear it.
Yeah, you kicked over some things for me as you talked about that. The brother-sister thing is interesting, and if you know, I think about Mormons used to have more time to talk to each other in church buildings. With the combined schedule, there isn't so much of that. So television? Yes, and then when you're away from church, you're watching TV. So there's that. Kids want to get home. But I almost remembered what I was going to say. No. I like the version. Anyway, what I was going to say was this, that when we used to do more of that, and even now, though, you know, you see a member of your ward in the church and there's something you want to say to her. Say it's a man and a woman. And you want to say something to her, you know, the proper, the formal way of saying it is sister so-and-so. But as was just revealed to us, some kind of separation does occur. And maybe it's a separation that is intended in some way. Since what if we called each other by our first names, both men and women? There's a certain intimacy to that. You know, there's a certain, Susan, I want to ask you something. You know, or George, you know, what if in our church we began to call each other by our first names? What would happen? Well, all kinds of things could happen. Would it be worrisome? Maybe so. Would it be breaking some barriers that might allow us to know each other? Maybe so. Would we have to watch ourselves, what we say and do, more carefully? Maybe so. But
you know, in another ward I lived in, a missionary came to the door not knowing if it was a member family, as we say, or not. And I introduced myself, said my name, and he said, "I'm Elder so-and-so." We talked for a moment, and I said, "What's your first name?" He felt very uncomfortable about even thinking about that he had a first name at that point. Because for some reason, that has been ingrained that you use the titles. And brother and sister have become a title as well. And if you actually revealed your first name, some of your humanity might actually leak out and something might happen between you. Well, I'm sort of for that kind of thing happening between us. And I think we can still recognize our brother and sisterness and talk to each other as if we were friends.
Do you mind if I just make another comment? I just realized as this last few comments were happening that there have been a few times when I have used those terms, brother and sister, and it's had a very uniting effect on me, a very positive effect. And those times were when I was in need and found myself in a distant place and had to contact church members that I didn't know and ask for help. Once was over the phone for my daughter who was suffering from a mental illness and who was stranded and needed someone to bring her some food. And I just phoned around till I found church members, you know, one province away and said, "Please, would you go down to the bus depot and give my daughter $10, I'll mail the money to you, or give her a lunch, please." They didn't know me from anybody. And that sort of thing I found. But in my own ward, I feel better with that intimacy that first names bring. Can I make one response to something you said, Jen, about the legislation, women's problems being fixed by legislation? I just want to make a comment from a feminist standpoint there that my explanation for that is that women, the legalities that around men and women are different. You know, women haven't been equal under the law, and that's why women's problems in that regard are fixed by changing the laws. And sometimes for men, for instance, you know, child visitations and support and that sort of thing. Nowadays, it's laws that are needed to mandate equality in that way. But that I think that's why we find that women's problems are being fixed by legal changes. And otherwise, I think women do have some that aren't being fixed by laws as well.
I have a question of women. As I was writing this and I made my list, it just really brought it across to me. Because my daughter, even from a really young age, said, "Why would God not give the priesthood, you know, to women? Why would God do that?" And when I was thinking of terms, and I gave that list, there's sister, Relief Society president, and then there's also a long list of hierarchy of male positions of power and movement and all those sorts of things. I would really like to hear from a woman, did that impact you, that your role was a specific title as opposed to this large list of hierarchy of power that men could hold. Did that affect any of you or not? Or do you not understand the question? Yes.
Could you come up? All right. I had to ask.
Thanks for sharing that. As I wrote out that, she asked that about it.
You don't want your opinion summarized on the paper?
The person talked about feeling and asking her Sunday school teacher growing up that if she had an inferior spirit because of that kind of message, and somehow she felt she did. It really struck me as I made out that list. I mean, I have been into these issues for a long time, but when I made that list, I thought how different it must be. But I don't want to project myself. For a woman to hear this, and I have this, you know, all these possibilities that carry with them rank, authority, signs of attention. And of course, the role is you always came back, you were supposed to be a mother. But that never limited me from being a father. Of course, I've given speeches about fathering. I think the twist to that is the mother's the mother, and the father are often absent from their children's lives, which I also think are tragic. You were going to say something.
Well, I was going to say, I grew up in San Francisco, and my dad wasn't a member, and my mother, you know, never went. And it never remotely occurred to me that, you know, my spirit was not as good as the boys or the men. I will say, you know, I'm not totally stupid. A few years later, it kind of, you know, dawned on me a little more. But growing up as a kid, it didn't. And on this calling each other brother and sister and all this, I don't know if somebody has to get permission. I'm a little past 50, and for the last 20 years, with the exception of somebody on the state presidency and maybe the bishop, I have called everybody, no matter what age they are, by his or her first name. And I have never had anyone look appalled or offended.
Try a doctor.
I've done that too.
You mean an MD?
I mean, not...
The comment was that this woman was had a little different experience as a child, though older. It shifted, and that for 20 years she has used first names. I must agree with that. I call everybody by their first names and really invite and hope they'll use my first name.
You're going to say something. This has been an interesting session for me. I think we do the same thing, not only with the brother and sister, but we have Gordon B. Hinckley, Bruce R. McConkie, just to formalize it. In my stake in Georgia.
What's your middle initial, by the way?
E.
E?
Yeah.
It doesn't have quite the same ring.
No. In my stake in Georgia, it's gotten to a kind of absurdity where the state presidency referred to one another, including their middle initial. And
really?
It just strikes us as kind of playing school, playing house, to try to lend that authority. I think we do it also with our manner of prayer. Using thou and thine and thee. For me, that makes it seem more distant. And when I pray, that's not what I'm looking for, is distance. So they don't ask me to pray. You. Yeah, thank you for whatever I'm thankful for. And then the other thing, for the longest time, I think it's been interesting as women have become more assertive and even aggressive in playing sports, a lot of people applaud that, and yet we call them, my university, for example, the women's teams are the Lady Eagles. And we're expecting these ladies to be ladylike, but still steal the ball or steal the base. Right. It's a real bind. So, just an observation.
I have another quick aside. On the opposite of that, I remember a nurse in Boston. I was about to give a speech, and I was talking to her, and she was sitting there decrying how insensitive men were and that they were unemotional and unapproachable. And I said, well, what kind of men are you attracted to? And she said, oh, I just love Sylvester Stallone and Rambo. And I thought, you know, what an interesting twist. How many emotional Rambos are there in the world? So, it cuts both ways.
There's an irony to your comment. We just returned from Germany, which has two whole sets of pronouns for the formal and the familiar, and then who gets to use the familiar pronouns with whom. And I was surprised to learn, and you might be surprised to know, that thee and thou used to be the familiar in our language, and you was the formal. And in Germany, you pray using the informal pronouns, even though you're referring to people you've just met in a formal way, and prayer is more intimate. So it feels more formal and more distant, but really the antecedents to that are a greater intimacy.
Is that the same in our church?
I'm just talking about that linguistically, how the pronouns work.
In,
yes.
In
oh,
Germany,
yes.
In
that's
the
right.
Latter-day Saint Church,
yeah.
We use the informal.
Yeah. I had to have that explained to me because it felt so wrong.
Thank you.
Thank you indeed. Yeah, we'll whip right over to Jan. I just want to say that I have taken in recent years to saying you, and then sometimes in the middle I forget and say the. I just feel more comfortable with you. It cuts down some kind of barrier.
Coming from a Presbyterian tradition, we Presbyterians don't have much that we can say, you know, you must hold all of these things to be self-evident truth. So we are invited to question so that we can figure out what really is the truth for us. And one of the things that has come to me, and I haven't had a chance to talk to many people about it, is that a lot of times we like to say Jesus was so perfect. And it seems to me that in my mind, Jesus made one major mistake that has rippled through history. That of those 12 people he picked to follow him, one of them was not a woman. Do you have any idea what that would have done to history if he had taken one woman? Because he had plenty of friends. He clearly respected them. There was no difference in terms of relationship that he chose. So you're suggesting maybe the woman was ignored by the men?
Well, this is supposed to be the end of the panel, but boy, as I knew would happen, everybody just got into it. New ideas and insights rippled out. What a beautiful thing. Thank you all so much. It's been a lot of fun. Thank you.
Hey, Rebecca. Thank you.
Oh, you'll
save
my
hand. That was an interesting exchange.
This is why.
Okay.
It was just touching.
No, I loved it.
I wish it hadn't been quite so
poor.
Hey, it works.
I mean, you brought in first and stuff every
time. No, it well, we all did our own thing.
Anything she wanted to be.
That's great.
Wonderful.
Oh, well,
that's great.
Oh,
thank you.
Very
thank
good.
You.
I love
that.
What there was real good about saying, you know what I mean? She'll say, what's